Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS FM and WETS HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, we've done a number of shows on that group of bespeckled, bewigged, old white guys we call the founders or sometimes the framers of the Constitution. And we've talked about people like George Washington. We certainly talked about Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin and all those other familiar people. And of course, especially James Madison. But one founder, one framer of the Constitution of whom you may never have heard is a fellow, well, you probably have heard of the university that's named after him. Have you ever heard of GMU? Are you a fan of March Madness? Do you watch basketball on television? Well, then maybe you've heard of GMU, and maybe if you've thought about it, you realize it was actually named for a guy, and his name was, appropriately enough, George Mason. Not George Mason University. His name was just George Mason. And George Mason was an extraordinarily important fellow who spent a lot of time at the Constitutional Convention, who made some extremely important suggestions. And when those suggestions were not adopted, well, he refused to sign it. And he went home. And he was not heard from again, at least by the general public. He was a very private man, but he'd made a very important suggestion, and the important suggestion he'd made was that maybe, just maybe, our Constitution should have a Bill of Rights. And a lot of people, especially during the ratification process, started thinking maybe George had a point. And in fact, when they eventually figured out that George had a very good point, they decided that maybe he'd actually written something that they could use as a model. Because you see, it turns out that George had already written one Bill of Rights. It's called the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and it was already in the Virginia State Constitution. So when the time came for James Madison to put things together, he started with many of the ideas, many of the concepts in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which so in many cases we can think of that Declaration of Rights as being the progenitor, as being the predecessor to our own Bill of Rights, and to a great extent, we have George Mason to thank for it. Now, like many of the founders, especially those from Virginia, George Mason was a plantation owner. He was a slaveholder. Interesting contrast, isn't it? These people are so concerned with rights were the same people who held slaves. But we'll put that issue aside for the moment. My point is that he had a really nice house, and his really nice house has a name. And it is called Gunston Hall, and Gunston Hall still exists. It's been preserved. Much of the estate has been preserved. Not all the thousands of acres, but several hundred acres still remain right there in the banks of the Potomac. And it's actually quite close to another place I'm sure you've heard of called Mount Vernon. Everybody goes to Mount Vernon, and not so many go to Gunston Hall. And that is a shame, because when you go to Gunston Hall, you can learn all about George Mason. And that's exactly what I recently did. In fact, let's start our conversation with some of the people at Gunston Hall, with the deputy director there. His name is Mark Watford. Among Mark's many duties is overseeing the archive of historic documents, some fascinating stuff that's kept at Gunston Hall. And we were looking at a really cool document, an actual copy of some of Mason's objections to the original seven articles of the Constitution, written in the hand of another founder, a fellow you may have heard of by the name of John Jay. Let's pick up my conversation with Mark just as he's describing this document to me.
Initially, Mason had sent the objections out, you can always correct me if I'm wrong on this, to Washington. And other copies were quickly made and disseminated around the country.
Right.
And I believe Washington was very strong in making sure that some of the strongest supporters of the Constitution received the objection, so they'd be prepared to answer any questions in regards to issues that were raised in their state, constitutional conventions in regards to the Constitution itself. And it's we recently had Jerry Gowalt here, who was talking on his book, George Mason and George Washington, he mentioned a brief passage about the Constitution, because the Constitution was really the breaking point between Washington.
Right. Well, can we back up a little bit?
Sure.
Now, my understanding is that Mason, to some extent, was Washington's tutor. early in life? I mean, that there was a sort of a mentor-mentee relationship between them? Or correct me, you correct me if I'm wrong.
No,
please.
You know what? Who's the name of that George Mason University professor? Peter Henriquez.
Uh-huh.
He never regarded that Mason and Washington were friends.
Mm-hmm.
He always thought that it was just simply a local landowner relationship.
Right.
But we do have evidence in the letters where Mason was constantly sending plantings up to Mount Vernon. Washington was asking advice on tutors for his stepchildren from Mason.
Mm-hmm.
There was a small difference in age, about 8 years.
Well, that sounds a little bit more friendly than just a business relationship or two
Henriquez
landowners.
Well, Henriquez based it on some of Washington's comments and about how if you were a true friend of Washington, the letters were addressed a certain way, and that address never appeared in correspondence between Washington and Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think Mason regarded Washington as a friend. And it's interesting to follow Washington's career after his brother Lawrence died and he inherited Mount Vernon. Mm-hmm. And Mount Vernon first looked like Gunston Hall when Lawrence had it built, typical Tidewater architecture.
Right.
That after Mason would purchase something, a set of salt glazed porcelain, Washington would soon follow. Set of creamware, Washington would soon follow. Mason also had the advantage of being wealthy from birth, so he really didn't have to prove himself to anyone.
Well, that suggests a relationship, because Washington was always trying to become a gentleman. Maybe
right.
That, maybe that's what it was.
He always wanted to be perceived as a gentleman.
And so maybe that was what it was. It was that Mason was the cool guy in the county, and
You know what? It's funny. I would never think of Mason as the cool guy. We have very few references to any sense of humor. He was very, very businesslike, and to be honest, he was very frugal at times.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he had his large family to take care of. The construction of Gunston Hall, he used local materials, local walnut, instead of importing mahogany or other. That some of the very wealthy did. But Mason had the advantage of dying when he passed away of being very well off, not mm-hmm. in debt, and he was able to give each of his sons a plantation. Although Washington did quite well for himself, too.
Yes. I think he did.
Yeah, it's a fascinating relationship. Although Washington continued to visit with and have meals with Mason's sons, even though he didn't speak to...
Tell us about that break. So they had some kind of relationship, whether
right.
it was friends or neighbors or
right.
mentor-mentee. They
yes.
they certainly communicated. They did a lot of the same stuff.
Right.
Same society.
Yes.
So what went wrong?
I think it was Washington's disappointment that there wasn't a unanimous approval among the convention delegates in regards to the Constitutional Convention. I think they were both kind of a little older and a little stubborn in their own way. They're
uh-huh.
both in there. Washington was in his late 50s
mm-hmm.
and Mason early 60s, and they were just kind of set in their ways. I think it was also because of Mason's work in the Richmond convention about how he spoke up against it. He and Patrick Henry.
The ratification convention.
Yes, the ratification.
Yeah. Washington had really kind of put himself on the line. I mean,
yes.
Madison convinced Washington to show up. George is the rock star
right,
of the
right.
18th century.
Right.
You know, this is me. I've got, this is, a, you know, you if you vote for the Constitution, you're kind of voting for George. You say,
right.
I agree with George, but
mm-hmm.
but George Mason is saying, I don't.
Right.
And arguing pretty strongly against that,
yes.
along with Patrick Henry. So I guess I can understand.
But it's, in a way, it's also funny because the way the process building to the Constitutional Convention, you had some discussions about the navigation of the Potomac, and Mason was involved in that, and then you had the Mount Vernon Convention. That
right, of 1785, yeah.
Then you had the Annapolis Convention, then all the delegates showed up,
mm-hmm.
and then again you go on to the convention in Philadelphia. And Washington, it's my belief that he had his fingers in it all the way. So
mm-hmm.
they could tell that the progress of the an author called it the First American Republic wasn't quite working as it should. So again, I think Washington was quite aware that we needed changes, and he was very good. He was quite on the public stage, and he knew how to play the public stage.
Right. And so when George Mason contradicted him, that was it for them. So
right.
Did they ever talk after that?
They had a couple of letters going back and forth about the reference for a coachman, but after that, they really had no contact.
Wow.
Then again, Washington would continue to visit Mason's son's home and entertain his sons at Mount Vernon.
Right. Wow, that's unfortunate that these feuds happen, and that happened for over 10 years. I think Washington lived another 10 or 11 years after ratification.
And also, I mean, he also feuded with Madison, he also feuded with Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was...
Mason did?
No, Washington.
Washington did. Yeah. Well, how did Mason relate to those other
actually,
Virginians?
He got along quite well with Madison and Jefferson, and Jefferson was one of the last visitors in the house a week before he died.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah. And actually, there was a reference in a Jefferson letter telling that he spoke to Mason and said, please, you know, save your voice. Mason was very hoarse and a little ill. So Jefferson was telling him he needed to rest. And actually, I believe Monroe was supposed to stop by and stay over, but Mason had died in that first week in October.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe Monroe went straight down to Richmond.
What year was that again that Mason
1792.
Died? 1792. Oh, okay, I said 10 years. That's how long Washington lived.
Yes.
Mason only, about 5 years after ratification.
Oh, then. A couple
four,
of years.
Four or
yeah,
five
yeah.
years, yeah, four
very
or five
quick,
years.
Very quick. But after the, again, after the Bill of Rights was passed, Mason said he would have gladly put his hand to the document. And Madison just simply incorporated many of...
Well, it barely did. You see, now that's very interesting because, of course, George Mason is most well known for mm-hmm. not having signed the Constitution
yeah.
because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights was, of course, only ratified in late 1791.
Yes.
And so he just barely stuck around
right.
long enough to see
right.
the Bill of Rights
right.
ratified, and only lasted a few more months.
Yes. Now, and as we celebrate Madison for the Bill of Rights, Madison made some number of unkind comments about it at the time because
uh-huh.
he thought it was just, I think someone pointed out, he said it was merely whipped syllabub. It was just appealing to the masses just to keep them
right.
happy.
Right. Madison had a lot of reasons
yeah.
he didn't think it was necessary,
yeah.
maybe even advisable,
yeah.
but Mason, of course, insisted upon it. Could we talk a little bit about Mason's contributions to the Bill of Rights? I mean, go all the way back to what he did for Virginia.
Oh, of course, of course. He was part of the... member of the what are they?
House of Burgesses.
House of Burgesses,
right.
And they moved over to the Assembly,
right.
He got the initial work done on the Virginia Bill of Rights, and that was right before. That was in May of 1776, I believe.
Okay. Independence.
Right before, and then it was incorporated. They had the local newspapers published it. Jefferson saw many of the words, and Jefferson incorporated many in our Declaration of Independence, many of the words that came from the Virginia Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And
again, there was also the progenitor of what ultimately became our Bill of
yes.
Rights. A lot of the stuff
yes.
that was in there eventually made its way into what was there. So there might have been just a matter of pride of authorship here.
Yes.
In fact,
yes.
I know Madison was often accused of being so proud of what he'd authored that's why he didn't want to amend it.
Right.
And I wonder to what extent George Mason, being a human being, might have just been miffed because he had all these good ideas that hadn't made it in.
I don't think so. I think he was a man very comfortable in his own clothes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in a way, he almost, to an extreme, really didn't care too much what people said about him because, again, he had the wealth. And he was a very private man out Mason Neck, as you can see how private
yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is
very private, yeah.
And he turned down quite a few number of appointments. He had a very weak record in the House of Burgesses. He was basically concerned with family issues out here. And again, having to raise the 9 kids after his first wife died.
Right.
Really concentrated on that. And also raising his personal income and wealth was very important to him, too. He was a businessman at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I know after the Constitutional Convention, he turned down an offer to become a senator from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
He also resigned as Justice of the Peace.
So he was a guy who liked to think a lot about government.
Yes.
And design governments, but he mm-hmm. didn't actually like to implement government.
No. And he also, there was a famous reference to his sons that it's best not to be on the public stage.
Well, that's fascinating because, of course, George Mason is among the most overlooked and neglected
yes.
of the framers. And I've often thought it's because he refused to affix his name to the document. So he's simply not there when you look at
right.
it. So that's easy
right.
to overlook him in that regard. But this seems to be another reason. If he's a guy who just really doesn't want to be on the public stage,
exactly.
well, then that contrasts pretty strongly with George Washington, James Madison,
right.
Thomas Jefferson,
right.
John Adams. All these guys are going out mm-hmm. there and taking public office. Mm-hmm. The only one, the other one I can think of who didn't do that was Benjamin Franklin. He was just too old.
Right.
Okay, and we already knew about him from all of his other stuff. But
yes.
Mason could have been much more prominent
mm-hmm.
if he'd wanted to be.
Yes.
Okay.
And actually... It's quite interesting. If those Jefferson and Madison had realized the extent of the slander that they would later be involved in later life,
mm-hmm.
many false accusations, would they have gone ahead with their careers as they did?
Yeah, maybe George Mason had a more pleasant life just
yes.
hanging out here rather than being on the public stage because.
Yes.
A lot of the founders found themselves in pitched battles.
Yes.
Were not very pleasant subsequently.
Right, right, right.
It's a lot different to think about government than it is to actually be in government.
Yes, of course. And as when they're kind of almost clothed in those robes of the Roman Senate just to sit and discuss and
right.
just hopefully all the common people will just listen to their words and follow along in that. But there's so much more involvement, and I think it was a great idea, and it grew beyond their expectations. But you also have to think: did it meet and exceed their expectations? Or even now, so many controversies are coming up regarding the Constitution. Has it just gone beyond? Would they have gone back and said we should have been a little more exact in our wording, or is it the perfect document as it is, where it's a little loose, so you can interpret it as the situation arises?
I think you've just stated one of the great constitutional controversies of all time,
yeah.
And to this day. How exactly do we go back and interpret it?
Right.
Well, what other documents do you have here?
Jay's objections here.
Jay's objections are extremely cool.
Where is this little one right here? Let me see here. No, I have that in a little folder right here. Ba-dum-bum-bum-bum. We have some actual... Sorry about that. Just
oh, perfectly all right.
Little letter.
What I find interesting is that in almost any archive you go into, they use the same sort of box that you have here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's
everywhere
easy
you
on the
go.
Shelves, yes.
Exactly. And I was doing some research on Henry Ford a couple of years back and was pulling stuff out of his archives. I'm glad to see you wearing your white gloves.
Here's some of Mason's actual notes from the Constitution.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Now, from the convention?
Yes.
Or good heavens.
Yes, this is just a reproduction showing the back. He decided against his idea after all.
Oh, okay. Let me take a picture of these, if I may.
I can
all righty. Just a second.
Out of this, out of the way there.
All right, now what am I looking at here? These are actual notes of George Mason from the Constitutional Convention. Let me
yes.
go over here where I'm not going to get a glare on it. Get as close as I can get without getting that glare there. And this is the reproduction on the left with
the
X through it.
That's the back side, yes.
Back side of it. You know, what's interesting about the X, regardless of what's beneath the X,
mm-hmm.
is that even George Mason, even people in the Constitutional Convention, they're human beings.
Yep.
They have ideas.
Yeah.
They reject those ideas. They write something down. They say, oh, no, that's stupid, and they
right.
cross it out.
Right.
And we often forget that.
Right.
We think of them as demigods. They weren't.
No, it's not like they sat down and knocked it off. I mean,
no.
it was just a continuous process of debate, and it was also like the work by any committee. It's not a perfect document, but it's something that everyone finally, for the most part, everyone finally agreed to and thought it was the best that we can produce.
The best that they could get, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, before we go, then, is there anything else you'd care to tell me about Gunston Hall or about George Mason or about the library here or your experiences here?
I can say I have a lot of fun. I enjoy what I do.
How does one get a job at Gunston Hall and get to handle these cool old documents and do work about George Mason?
I have a background in archives and a big history fan and also an undergraduate degree in archaeology. And I worked a number of archives in a larger corporate firms. This is my first nonprofit, and I like it. It's still very involved and a lot of pressure sometimes, but it's just the pleasure with the meeting the people and discussing the ideas. And
do you find that most of your duties are dealing with people like me who are coming and doing research, or is it more outside looking for new documents?
It can be a lot of researchers coming in. Now, I don't remember the gentleman's name, but I recently had an interesting discussion with the former editor of the George Washington Papers, and we were discussing whether Mason and Washington had the same tutor, because all we have is the gentleman's last name, and I think I can't recall it, but it was a very common last name. Mason's education was largely early age through tutors, and then he spent a number of years reading his uncle's library, John Mercer. John Mercer was originally an Irish immigrant, and he became quite a successful attorney, and he had a plantation farther down the Potomac called Marlborough. He was so vocal at times he was disbarred and then had to wait a while to be allowed back in.
Right.
But he also had a quite sizable library, over 1,200 volumes for the 1740s and 50s. Was quite large. And it's our belief, then, just through historic record, that Mason spent most of his time reading in his uncle's library, because we do have a rough idea of the library collection, and we can see how many of those books not only influenced his thinking on business and political matters, but also in his design of the interior of the home. So his uncle was after his father's death, his uncle was his guardian. I think it was a great opportunity for Mason. There you go, sir.
Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
I will take this with me, and I will take look at it.
Our collection is online
through
the Founding Fathers Consortium with Stratford Hall and Mount Vernon.
And how does one get to it online?
You can go to the Gunston Hall website, go to the library page, and you can see our OpenStack, the rare book collection and document collection.
And
same with Mount Vernon also.
GunstonHall.org.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you
very,
very
Thank
much
you.
For your time.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're on a visit to Gunston Hall, the historic home of George Mason. Never heard of him? Well, shame on you. But don't worry about it. After the break, we'll tell you all about it right after we finish our constitutional quiz. Stick around.
We're here on another beautiful spring day in Montpelier, in Orange, Virginia. I'm here with the quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, how are you?
And I'm doing very well. Now, who are our contestants today?
Rosalia from Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey.
Egg Harbor Township.
Near Atlantic City.
Near Atlantic City. Okay, and Rosalia, and who else?
Tony from the same location.
Tremendous.
I'm her consort.
Her consort. That's an interesting. Okay, very good. Her consort. And what question do we have for the consorts today?
We have a question about social contract. A social contract is an agreement, A, among people to get along with one another, B, among people that is not written, C, among the people to set up a government, or D, between two governments.
Wow, B. Social contract.
An agreement among people that is not written.
Yes.
I would agree with Rosalia. It's B.
B, an agreement between people that's not written. But let's make sure we go through everything. So what was A?
A was an agreement. So a social contract is an agreement among people to get along. Let's get along with
to
one another.
To get along. Okay, sort of a kumbaya agreement. Okay.
That's a subcategory of B.
Okay, so we don't like A, we still like B.
I think we're not going to get a hat.
What was C?
C was an agreement among the people to set up a government.
Agreement among the people to set up a government.
No, it's definitely not that.
That's a subcontract.
Yeah, but it's not a social contract.
Okay, what do you say, Kelly? What's D?
D, an agreement between two governments.
An agreement? No?
That's definitely
not it. No, that's a treaty. That's a compact.
He sounds pretty certain. Is that your final answer? Then
you're going to final answer
is B.
B.
You know, Stuart, this is one that I'm going to have you do a ruling on because technically, the answer in my paper is C,
which
that it's
was
agreement
what?
Among the people to set up a government. But mm-hmm. I think that there's some validity that it's also an agreement among people that is not written. I'm going to have to go to our scholar here.
I really
rule on this one. I don't know.
I hate to do this, but I have to agree with the book. It is the social contract theory of government is the full term here.
Ah, you didn't tell me.
No,
okay, that's why I feel like it's not written. Had we said theory of government.
I'm a psychologist. Okay. I'm thinking social contract.
That's why
I'll tell you what we're going to do. The correct answer is C. Social contract is an agreement among people to set up government. And the whole idea behind this is that people give up individual freedom in order to gain the protection of being part of a government. But I agree with you. I think maybe that question was a little bit ambiguous. So
we get a hat.
You get a hat. Yay! Nonetheless. All
Let
right.
Let me just point out.
Yes.
I was about to say C, but my wife said B.
Now the blame begins.
So I deferred to my wife.
I think you better give her the hat then, because if you're going to blame her,
I think we better redo our social contract.
She wants to redo her social contract with you.
And I knew she was wrong, but if I contradicted her and had been proven correct, she would have gotten angry at me for the next 5 days.
I decided to go along and pretend that she was right. I think
the
things are going to be pretty upsetting in New Jersey for a while here. I think maybe there's going to be some trouble.
Yeah, well, enjoy your tour while you're here at James Madison.
Thank you.
I'm glad I fought for you for the hat.
I agree that I think we could have written this question
a little bit better.
Thank you very much. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris, and I am speaking with all kinds of interesting people at Gunston Hall, the historic home of George Mason, the fellow who insisted that we have a Bill of Rights and who contributed enormously to its drafting and its ultimate adoption. We just finished our discussion with Mark Watford, who's the deputy director of Gunston Hall, and he told us all about the archives there and a lot about George Mason himself. Now we're going to speak to a woman. Her name is Mavis, and by coincidence, she's from southwestern Virginia, where the Appalachian School of Law is, but I get ahead of myself. Mavis's day job is as a tour guide at Gunston Hall, and she's going to give us just a heck of a tour.
My name is Mavis Dzulovich, and I'm a guide here at Gunston Hall. So I give wonderful people like you tours through Gunston Hall and try to give them an idea of what it would have been like when George Mason lived here.
Tremendous. Well, we feel very lucky to have you. So please proceed.
All right. You've just entered the house, and the floor plan here on the first floor is typical of any Georgian-style house. This house was actually constructed between 1755 and 1759 by George Mason IV.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was...
And he's the George Mason we are always talking about.
Right.
Okay.
He is the George Mason who is the author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights, the document that our Bill of Rights to the Constitution is based
okay,
on.
But there were three before him, so I just wanted to make sure...
In this country. There were more in England.
For heaven's sake.
In this country,
okay.
He's the fourth.
All right. Okay.
And he chose this site as the... site of his home. So he built the house, as I said, between 1755 and 59. They were ensconced here by 1760. And it's a wonderful Georgian style house. This is a very elegant house for that period in our history here in the colonies. It's a brick house.
Mm-hmm.
You saw walking up. And at the time, about 80% of all the people in the colonies were still living in wooden structures of some kind. So many of those were still log cabins with third floors. So you can imagine how elegant this house would have been.
Right.
And so the Masons were among the wealthier families in Virginia, I'm guessing.
Oh, yes. George Mason was in the top 1% to 2% of wealth in the entire country.
Okay.
So we are going to move into the formal dining room.
Okay,
first.
Great. Fabulous.
Now, let's assume you were invited here for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because they used these two rooms, the formal dining room and the formal parlor, only for very important people
or
occasions.
I am important.
Of course.
That's why I'm here.
You're gentry or you would never have made it through that front door.
Absolutely.
There.
And all of our listeners are important, so they're here in spirit.
Yes, they are.
Okay, good, good. So we've got that straight then, okay.
Today we would assume that perhaps the Washingtons have come over. Now, Mount Vernon's only about 7 miles up the river here.
So they were buds.
Yes,
George and George and George were buds.
Most of their lifetime, right. Exactly.
Okay.
Good friends and neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
So they perhaps have been invited here for dinner. At that time in history, dinner was served around 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Their later meal was called supper, which we still call that in the South in many cases.
Right.
But they ate dinner around 2 in the afternoon because it took them a long time to cook. Mm-hmm. Over an open hearth in a building separate from the house.
We were just there, yeah, we saw that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
They were very afraid of fire. That was a major concern at that time. So
mm-hmm.
all your cooking was done away from the house and they carried in.
Mm-hmm.
So these two rooms were closed up a good portion of the time and not used unless, as I said, it was a very important occasion or family. So that's why I say perhaps the Masons and the Washingtons are dining today because we only have 4 chairs around the table. This room is an unusual room to find in a home here in the 18th century because it's finished in what's called chinoiserie or the Chinese style.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
This was the rage in England at that time, but it really hadn't made its way to the colonies. George Mason acquired a young man from England as an indentured servant.
Mm-hmm.
That man's name was William Buckland. He arrived here shortly after Mason had broken ground. His indenture or term that he was to work off was 4 years. So he's here literally the whole time the house is being finished. Therefore, we assume he was brought here primarily to finish the interior of the house. Mason obviously had floor plans.
Mm-hmm.
But Buckland,
I must comment, you mentioned Chinese, and then as soon as you did, I saw that mantelpiece.
Yes.
That's the most unusual mantel I've ever seen.
The peaks there are to represent waves, you know,
yeah.
in the Chinese style.
Right.
And look above the doors and the fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
The little roof-like features that you see there
sort of like
look
a pagoda.
Like little pagoda
yes,
tops.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Now that you mention it, yes, yes.
Yeah, they're called hoods. That's the architectural term for them. But they do look like pagoda tops. And look at this wonderful paint in here. This mm-hmm. yellow ochre is the original color of paint.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
And you were able to figure that out with a...
Yes, we have the science and technology to determine the paint colors throughout the house. So basically, as we move through this house today, the colors are going to reflect the colors that were here when George Mason lived here.
Oh, that's nice.
Now, the wall coverings, it's a different story. We had to do a lot of very careful research
mm-hmm.
and then some educated guessing
mm-hmm.
Because we didn't have enough evidence to determine that. We don't have the ability to determine that unless we have original material with enough evidence to mm-hmm. create it from. But this is a copy of an 18th century English paper that is currently on display at Winterthur Museum up in Delaware. So.
Okay, so this was as close as... This is your best guess, then.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
So this is
exactly.
something from the era that might have been here, or if it wasn't exactly this, it probably would have been something similar.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We feel pretty confident after the work that we've done and the research we've put into it that we know it's possible. All of these wall coverings are possible for that period and for George Mason.
Right.
With the amount of money that he had.
Sure, sure. Now, I have to ask, everything is elegant in this room, and it's a very, very finished room, with the exception of the floor, which seems relatively rough hewn. Was this how it looked when it was here? And was there a reason it wasn't more finished looking or covered in some way?
No, the floors were not finished. They were rough hewn boards. This is yellow pine that you're looking at
mm-hmm.
here. Now, in the winter months, they very likely would have rolled out a good carpet in here.
Mm-hmm.
They usually brought their carpets out around October, so when it started to get chilly.
Mm-hmm.
And then they roll them back up in the spring, when they started opening the doors and windows
mm-hmm.
because they're getting all kinds of dirt, dust, bugs, and things like that in here. And so they didn't want it on the carpet. And the boards are cooler in the summer.
Sure there would be, yeah.
So that's generally the way it was done. They had a major spring housekeeping and a fall housekeeping season where they move things around a bit. We do that too. We'll be doing that next month here in May.
Okay.
The furniture in this room is all 18th century, but the only pieces in this room currently that belong to George Mason are his flatware that you see here on the table and on the side table over here in front of the knife boxes. Those three boxes would hold silver in a vertical position. And this chair fragment that you see here is the framework of a chair that that young Buckland designed for George Mason.
Ah.
He probably designed about a dozen chairs, several tables, and so forth for this house, because architects at that time designed interiors, buildings, churches, and furnished them, furniture for them. But to our knowledge, that is the only fragment of a Buckland piece still sitting in a room for which it was designed.
Wow.
Buckland came here in his early 20s. He died at a fairly early age. So he didn't have a long career span, although he did do some important work in this area. Up in Maryland, he worked on the Maryland State House in Annapolis. There's a portrait of Buckland in our museum there.
Yeah, we just saw that, right?
And beneath
he was a good-looking fellow.
He was. Very handsome young man.
Yes, he was.
And beneath his hand on the table are plans for the Hammond Harwood House, which is a very important feature in Maryland as well. Mm-hmm. So we feel very fortunate to still have that piece. If you find Buckland pieces today, they're going to be in a museum. They're few and far between. And,
wow, okay.
Very difficult to...
I'm just curious, do you think that there are other original Mason pieces out there that you might be able to acquire one day?
Oh, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are.
So if anybody has an original Mason piece or thinks
bring it
that,
to us.
Okay, can you give you
let
a call?
Let us know.
Okay, all right, all right.
We'll get in touch with you.
Montpelier underwrites the show, and I spend a lot of time out there, and we've actually talked with them, and they're currently in a worldwide hunt for Madison stuff.
And so are we.
So are you, okay.
One of the reasons that we don't have more Mason pieces today is because we do not have Mason's inventory, his furniture inventory,
right,
which is a very important document for any historic site. And usually every historic house is going to have an inventory, very detailed.
Right.
We don't know what happened to Mason's. Might have been destroyed in a descendant's home, a fire, thrown away, whatever, a flood, right, you know, anything could have happened to it. But because we don't have that document, we have to do a lot of research. We're always
that would be the Gunston Hall Rosetta Stone.
Yes.
So if anybody happens to have a book that looks like it might contain that information,
exactly,
I imagine you'd like them to call you too.
Exactly.
Alrighty.
We will certainly look at it.
Okay.
We can tell you a lot about it if it's not, even if it's not Mason's. I'm sure we have people who could do that. So yes, we're always looking for Mason pieces and trying to get more back.
Okay.
I'll point out the Mason pieces as we move through the house today.
Okay.
We're going to go back out in the hallway.
Okay.
Before we take a look at the formal parlor.
Mm-hmm.
So we can discuss this a little bit more. The design here in the hallway. This is a very classic design.
Mm-hmm.
You have a bit of Grecian influence with these Doric pilasters.
Yes.
But you notice all of this white. This is all hand-carved wood. This is not plaster.
Wow.
Mason had a lot of money. I keep emphasizing that because he was in the top 1%. And he obviously understood Georgian house because it's Georgian design. Mm-hmm. This is a Georgian style house, so lots of symmetry in this house.
Now, for the architecturally challenged among us, and I've heard the Georgian and Georgian described years and years, who was the George in question after whom it was named? Was it George III?
It was named after the Georges, several Georges.
Several Georges.
During the reign, it became popular during the reign of the Georges in England, and there were six of them.
Okay.
Basically, it started around the early 1700s, about 1720 to about 1820.
Okay.
And it's characterized by lots of symmetry. They liked to keep things balanced. They thought that was very restful to the eye. And you can see that here in this hallway, which is one of the reasons I wanted to bring you back out here. If you have a door on one side, you'll have one on the other to balance it.
Right.
In the 18th century, typically, all of your doors were kept closed. So that gave you even more the appearance of symmetry in a space because the doors were kept closed. In the 18th century, basically, you're only going to see what they want you to see when you come into their house. Your business might be conducted right here in this hallway, and then you're sent on your way because they're not entertaining. You're simply over here to do a little business, to drop letters off, or to pick up something of that nature from Mason. And so the servant would greet you at the doorway, perhaps Mason's personal manservant, James. They would be wearing the Mason uniform or livery, bring you in here, state your business. Depending on your business, if they could conduct it here, that's where it was done. And you're not going to see any more of the house. That's why it was important to make your entryway as decorative as you did your other formal rooms.
Right.
So this hallway and those two rooms are going to be more highly decorative than the bedroom on this side and the little parlor on this side. One side of the house mirrors the other, but this is domestic space over here. This is formal space here.
Okay.
And because this is perhaps your only look at Gunston, he's going to put all this hand-carved wood in. He's going to paint it. He's going to bring in these imported papers. The paper in this hallway is actually a copy of an 18th century English paper.
Right.
And we know it was very popular up and down the East Coast. It was advertised in the Virginia Gazette at that time. And it also told you it was a paper that should be used in hallways and stairwells, which is
okay.
where we wanted to put
it. Well, it sounds like a pretty good guess then.
Yeah.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Mavis Dzulovich, who is a tour guide at Gunston Hall, the historic home of founder George Mason. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Mavis Dzulovich. Stick around. Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Mavis Dzulovich, a tour guide at George Mason's historic home, Gunston Hall.
Well, look at the stair landing there.
Right.
See the solid color that's painted?
Right.
We can date the paint. That's the color Mason had. Look at the background in this paper. And look at this original carving here, these two pilasters and the double arches, and
right.
that pine cone finial coming down there.
Right.
It just mirrors it as you move up those arches.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
called pillar and arch paper. So it's lovely. I think that's a very, very good wall covering for this space.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of original wood, as I said before, including all of the steps in the main staircase except the first one. The first step has been replaced. All the others are original.
Okay.
And again, yellow pine. The dark wood that you see on the doors and the staircase banister there, solid black walnut. So this is, again, a very elegant house. Lots of houses at that time, important houses, would paint pine to look like an expensive wood. We have the real
expensive
wood.
Yes, it was. Now, I have to ask now, there are a number of chairs lining each side of this. Now, is that a modern contrivance, or is that did they actually have a lot of chairs at the time? For those
visitors
that would
come in. They would have kept lots of chairs. Usually in the inventories, sometimes in the 18th century, you would find hundreds of side chairs,
mm-hmm.
Windsors like these, because they're easy to move around.
Right.
Now, your furniture is going to be constantly moved wherever you need it in the house and set up to accommodate whatever use you're making of a room at a particular time. And the servants did all the moving. Masons didn't move furniture.
Right.
So in the summer months, again, or when it started to get warm, you're going to have these doors and windows open, get a little cross breeze through here. So you're going to be a little bit more comfortable. They might even bring your tea table out here and serve your tea in the afternoon. And we do know that this part of the hallway that we're standing in would have been used for dancing.
Right.
They would have rolled up the floor cloths that they would have likely covered the floor with out here, have their fiddler stand on the landing there so he could see the dancers. They would be doing the Virginia reel down here,
right.
line dances like that.
Sure.
Perhaps some minuet and other things. So lots of entertaining took place in here.
Sure.
And this is typical of what you would have found here.
Very nice.
Okay, I guess we'll have to go to the... Let's go back and look at the back part of the hallways. Yes. The doors here, mentioned to you that, we're going to try to maintain symmetry.
Right.
That's the working door that goes down the servants' passage there. This
okay.
is a false door hung across from it to mimic the working door.
So that's not really a door. That's just for the symmetry.
It's hung on a brick wall. Goes nowhere. But we have a working door on that side, so when you look into this space, it, especially entering from either door, it looks very symmetrical. They go to great lengths to try to maintain that appearance. It's not always symmetrical either. Sometimes it can be a few inches off. But when you walk in, when you take a look at it, you're like, oh, that is so restful because everything is very balanced.
It is. I must admit that I have a great liking for this type of architecture.
I
find it very restful.
Well, let me show you something else here.
Mm-hmm.
Usually in a Georgian-style house like this, now here, as I said, we have the hallway, two very large rooms on either side. So in most Georgian designs, one floor mirrors the other. So when you go to the second floor, you have a central hallway or passage, two very large rooms on either side. But Mason deviated a bit from that style here, because on the second floor of Gunston Hall, we have seven bedrooms and a storage room running dormer style. So this is basically an eight-bedroom house, and you would never know that from looking at it.
Right.
Better use of space. And if you look on the stairwell here, you see a window.
Yes, yes, I do see.
A little unusual to find a window on the inside of the house. Well, that room is the storage room I mentioned. That's mm-hmm. where they kept out-of-season household items, linens and things of that nature stored. The window is on the stairwell instead of being on this wall, because if they had put it on this wall, this side of the house... Thank goodness we only have one chime.
Yes, if we'd come later in the afternoon, it would have been much more disturbing, yes.
The window, if it had been on this side of the wall, would have made an extra window. Six windows on this side on the second story, only five windows on that side. We have a land entrance and a river entrance.
So, once again, to preserve the symmetry, he actually...
They moved it inside. It's called a robber window. It robs light from this dormer back here and illuminates that room up there. You're going to see we go upstairs.
Okay.
Plenty of light. You don't have to light a candle during the daytime.
Very nice.
And since we're back here, let's take a look at the gardens from back here, and then we'll go in and look at the most heavily carved room in the house.
Okay.
George Mason's gardens here, after well over 12 years of archaeological research, have now been restored to the exact 1 acre dimension we have recorded, and the pathways, this central path, the one that bisects it, and the perimeter path are exactly where they were for George Mason. The boxwoods that you see lining the main path here, and some of the remnants here as well, are from boxwoods that George Mason planted when he lived here. So they're well over 260 years old.
Wow.
And that's very old for English boxwoods. They're not known for longevity. Now, if you look past the gardens, you see the line of trees there.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't part of Mason's landscape. His land was cleared all the way down to the Potomac. Looking off to the left, you get an idea of how far the river is. It's a mm-hmm. good half mile, probably.
Right.
But those were all cleared. His land was cleared down to the river, and they had a commanding view of the Potomac River. So it was very important at that time to watch the traffic on the river. It was a major highway for them at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we've lost his view now after over 250-some years of growth.
Susan and I were talking about that, and I understand there's an ongoing debate about whether that should be cleared again to restore the view.
Yes, there's so many ecological concerns today.
Sure, yeah.
You know, marshes. We have an eagle sanctuary near Gunston.
Mm.
Just all kinds of things that they're very carefully studying before they do any major.
Sure.
You see the small boxwoods that are planted here.
Mm-hmm.
That is closer in appearance to what George Mason would have had lining the pathways and perimeters of his gardens. They were usually referred to as border box.
Right.
And they were normally kept under a foot tall. So again...
Seriously?
Yes. So that's...
No, you're not kidding.
50 years of growth. Right.
That's what it would have... I mean, it looks almost like little footlights along,
along
the pathway.
They were usually kept that. And the green squares you see there in Mason's time would likely have been planted with vegetables. Maybe a few little flowers out there.
Now, once again, we see we see a conflict. On the one hand, who would ever want to cut down the original boxwoods?
Right.
I mean, they're masons.
Right.
So they're historic. On the other hand, they don't look anything like they did then.
Exactly.
So
and it's always a dilemma.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Are we going to go strictly? And in some cases, it's almost an impossible dilemma, to overcome. Because certain things, furnishings and so forth, and paints and all of that, the studies behind those are just...
It's never an easy solution, is it? Okay.
I also noticed the interior shutters on all the windows on this level.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a bit of privacy at night, perhaps keep a little bit of warmth in the house in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Impossible to really warm the house
mm-hmm.
because you're only warmed by fireplaces, and they don't heat a room. They heat a little area in a room.
Right.
So let's look at the other room on the formal side now, and then we'll take a look at the domestic space in the
mm-hmm.
house.
You've mentioned several times the seasonal aspects of the house. You've mentioned that the rugs were brought out in the cold months. You've talked about the windows and the window coverings. I think that's something that modern listeners might not, especially younger people, We grow up in air conditioning. We grow up with central heat. We are increasingly divorced from our natural environment. But even a grand house like this was intimately interconnected with its natural environment. And so you had to live that way. And the house had to be functional in the way that, because it was going to be very actively operated throughout the year. And that's very striking about this.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this, even today for me, seems a very livable house, which I know a lot of houses from that period don't feel that livable.
Right.
That you could kind of move in and move about the house.
Right.
It's convenient.
Oh, I could hang out here.
Yeah. Well, look at this room you're in.
I could do this.
This is the formal parlor. Look at this room. Everything you're looking at here in white is all hand-carved wood.
This is extraordinary. This is remarkably ornate. And is this the sort of, what was the fellow's name again who did all of that?
Well, William Buckland probably designed it. He would have been assisted by a large number of people because they're only using hand tools. None of this was done with any modern tools whatsoever.
Yeah, that's a lot of work in this room.
There was a master carver here, also another indentured servant. His name was William Bernard Sears. Mm-hmm. He would have assisted Buckland, but they probably had some skilled craftsmen that were paid, and they probably had other indentured servants brought over from England, Ireland, Scotland, and Germany, which is where our records show Masons indentured came from. They would be brought over specifically to carve, and probably some highly skilled slaves here as well.
Right.
To do this, to finish all this work with hand tools in 4 years is amazing. This has been called perhaps the most highly decorative room in all of 18th century Virginia.
Because of the amount
of hand-carved wood in here.
Mm-hmm. It's been a long time since I've been up the river to Mount Vernon. I'm going to rectify that before too long, but my recollection is that it was not nearly this ornate. It's much more simply decorated than this.
It's hard to compare. You really can't compare. It's like apples to oranges. Mm-hmm. That was a farmhouse, and it's a wooden house, and other features inside as well.
Mm-hmm.
For its time, it was a very nice house.
Oh, yeah, very nice, but I see what you're saying. This is probably the most highly decorated.
It's an amazing house.
It is. I mean, we haven't even talked about the gold, is it leaf or the gilt on the...
This is gold gilding.
Uh-huh.
Around all of these shelves.
That's actual gold.
We brought a craftsman up from Williamsburg to actually do this work for us, an expert. After years of careful research again... And then we have Prussian blue behind the shelves there. Mm-hmm. And then the white paint is the original color of paint on these walls here.
What's really striking about this also is that you think of the framers of the Constitution, the founders of the country, as living in these austere marble palaces. And you sort of think of them in a monochrome way. You know, everything would be white or off-white or something like that. But this is a very colorful room.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And we have... silk damask on the walls here, very brilliant red.
Can I touch it?
Yes,
okay.
That's what it's been touched many times.
Touched many times. All right, good. Yes, yes.
And that's wool flocking on it, which gives you that fabulous...
Oh, yes, it's three-dimensional.
Three-dimensional
quality
that you're seeing here.
Yep.
Now, again, this room, let's say you were...
I know why you put that there, because before you did, people were putting their hands all over the walls, weren't they?
Especially school children.
Yes, they were all over the walls.
We get lots of school children here, typically through the week.
Right.
So they love to go. That's the first thing they do. So very quickly, we hand them this little scrap and say, pass this around.
There you go. All right.
It helps.
Right.
Now, again, this room is... very elegant room here. Only two guests here today, so you can see we've got a card game laid out.
Right.
They loved to gamble in the 18th century. That was true for both the ladies and the gentlemen.
Oh, really?
Yes. In Virginia, it's said that the favorite activities in the 18th century of all ladies and gentlemen were drinking, gambling, and dancing, and they're not sure in what order.
So they
did like to have fun.
I see.
So we've got cards laid out there that on George Mason's card table. The card table did belong to George Mason, as did the chair in front and the one on either side here. We've got lots of silver in our collection from George Mason. The rest of this furniture is all 18th century. Furniture pieces did not belong to Mason. But you see the silver is little beakers on the table, candlesticks. Mm-hmm. You see a number of pieces on the shelves over here.
This is really curious, Mavis, because, silver and these small silver pieces are very portable and very valuable. I would have thought those would have been the first things carted off, and whereas furniture is much less portable and probably pound per pound less valuable, and yet that's what's gone. So why do you still have all of Mason's silver?
Because it was so valuable, so they probably took very good care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And silver is not going to be destroyed as easily as wooden pieces of furniture, or a flood come through and your furniture's damaged or something.
Well,
like
I find
that.
It interesting. Was it actually passed down with the house all those years?
Yes.
Has it always stayed with the house? Okay. Well,
some pieces we found and brought back.
Oh, okay, okay.
So, right. Not all of this. No, okay. We found one very important piece in our collection, though, I must point out to you. You see the bowl on the bottom shelf?
Yeah, it
over
looks
there.
Like a crown almost, yeah.
Yes, and it's called a Monteith bowl. Mm-hmm. They probably used it to put a little ice from the Potomac in, maybe chill something down. You didn't put ice in glasses or anything like that at that time in history.
Okay.
But if you needed something chilled, a little pudding or something, you might use it. But it is also the bowl that was used to christen the Mason children from. Because quite often in the 18th century, your christenings and your weddings were actually held in the homes instead of churches. Mm-hmm. There weren't that many churches. In the winter, the roads were bad. You didn't have that many preachers, so you couldn't depend on everybody to get there. And travel was really a trial at that time. So you would hold them in your house. You had, you know, the relatives and friends come over and stay for a long time, days, weeks, and perhaps a month. Usually they would hold those events in the winter. Because it's downtime on the plantation. The ground's frozen. You can't work the soil.
Right.
So you have a little bit of downtime. You can't work out on the land. And so you would invite people over to come to those occasions here in the house. Now you have on the wall behind me here copies of the wedding portraits of George Mason IV and his first wife, Anne Eilbeck. She's actually wearing her blue wedding dress in that portrait. It was not traditional for brides to marry in white again at that time in history.
Oh, really?
That came in later, more towards the Victorian period.
Was blue the traditional color at that time?
No, you wanted to show fine fabric. You wanted to show silk and satins and jewels, everything that she's doing in that portrait. She was from a wealthy family across the river in Maryland, German ancestry, and she's 16. He's 25, the year they married, 1750, the year the portraits were painted. Now, they were married for 23 years, and Anne produced 12 children during that time.
Wow.
She died at the age of 39, probably of complications from the last childbirth.
So many women did in those
yes.
days. Yeah, but wow. But that sort of surprises me, though, because obviously she could bear children. I mean, and she'd done it successfully many times.
Probably too many times.
Maybe that's what it was, yeah.
Too many times, too close together, and not having the same kind of medical care that we have today.
Right.
The average age of a woman at that time was actually 40. And, of course, childbirth was the major cause of death for women.
Yeah,
at
it,
that
was.
Time.
It was.
Of the 12 children, though, 3 died as infants, 9 lived to grow to adults, and those 5 boys and 4 girls, produced 59 grandchildren for George Mason.
Good heavens.
Travel around, you're going to find Masons pretty much throughout the world.
Well, Mavis, I have to thank you very, very much for your time. This has been a fascinating tour.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I'm sure
you're more than welcome.
And you can give a shout-out to all your friends in Abingdon now if you want to.
Hi, folks.
Okay, yes, Mavis is originally from Abingdon, right near where I live in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. So we're very happy to have her and very happy to have spent this time with her. So thank you very much again.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Mavis Dzulovich, who gave us that wonderful tour of Gunston Hall. Thanks also to Mark Watford, the deputy director at Gunston Hall, for telling us all about the archives and about George Mason himself. And a special thanks to Susan Blankenship, who arranged all of this, and of course to Patrick Ladden, who runs the whole place. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment. Next time on your weekly constitutional, George Mason and Gunston Hall. Never heard of them? Well, shame on you, and shame on your civics teacher for not talking about George Mason. But don't worry, if you tune in, we'll tell you all about him.